Next case is Fisher against Warden. This is case number 22-2846. Smith?
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Elena Meth, on behalf of plaintiff appellant, Ms. Kelly Rihanna, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Ms. Rihanna was repeatedly, violently raped in prison because of defendants' failure to protect her from a known risk of sexual assault. Her claims are timely for 3 reasons. First, the claims are timely under New Jersey's General Personal Injury Statute of Limitations, as modified by its revival provision, NJS Section 2A14-2B. Second, the claims are subject to statutory equitable tolling because Ms. Rihanna was prevented from filing by the trauma of these repeated violent rapes. And third, the claims are entitled to common law equitable tolling because the threats Captain Fitzgerald made against Ms. Rihanna, which were intended to follow her wherever she went, reasonably prevented her from filing within the limitations period. So first, turning to the revival provision that's at issue here, and it's most instructive to look to the Supreme Court's guidance from Owens and Wilson. In Owens and Wilson, the Supreme Court set out a scheme for how to determine what statute of limitations is most appropriate to apply to federal claims that don't otherwise have an accompanying federal statute of limitations. And there, the court said that you apply whatever the general or, residual statute of limitations is for any personal injury actions without differentiating between intentional torts or specific types of torts. But importantly, in those cases, the Supreme Court only discussed statutes of limitations and did not turn to issues of whether tolling or revival provisions must also apply to all personal injury actions.
All right, so when it comes to the general statute of limitations, you'd agree that we don't apply torts under a Bivens case. We don't apply tort specific. We apply the general state statute of limitations.
That's right? Correct.
But your argument, as I understand it, is that because this is a revival, you spend some time in the brief explaining why this is a revival provision, not a standard statute of limitations, a different approach should apply. Why? I'm not sure why the default position shouldn't be that when you apply the general tort statute of limitations to Bivens cases, you would also apply general revival statutes rather than tort-specific revival statutes.
Your Honor, instead of looking at it as a different approach, we actually look at it as the approach that's provided through Owens and Wilson. So in addition to saying that you should apply the general tort statute of limitations, the Supreme Court also said that courts should apply the full state law as it comes, including questions of revival, tolling, and application. And in Hardin specifically said at page 539 that courts should not unravel state limitations rules unless their full application would defeat the goals of the federal statute at issue. So taking that guidance that courts should be applying state law as it comes without unraveling it unless there were to be some conflict, which there's not here, the most straightforward application would be to apply the New Jersey revival provision, regardless of the fact that the revival provision applies only to a certain subset of claims, because it accompanies the general statute of limitations provided by New Jersey. And further, the case is easy here because the New Jersey revival provision explicitly mentions the state's general personal injury statute of limitations in its text. So there's no question about what the underlying statute is or what's being applied, as perhaps has been a concern in other cases. Here, it's obvious.
Why isn't the Second Circuit right that if the guidance in Owens is the court should abstain from a factual analysis for purposes of determining the statute of limitations? And they said it would strain credulity to say that we're going to engage in that analysis for a revival provision. Why wouldn't the concept of abstaining from a factual analysis carry over to revival?
Your Honor, we disagree with the analysis that the court performed in the Second Circuit because it's not true to what the Supreme Court indicated is allowed in terms of factual analysis through Hardin. So in Hardin, the Supreme Court did perform a certain type of factual analysis by examining the class of plaintiffs that was allowed to use the revival, or excuse me, the tolling provision that was at issue there. And the Supreme Court did so knowing that that would require some kind of factual investigation to be done by the reviewing court, and still found that that was an acceptable amount of factual review to be done and wouldn't be otherwise intrusive or raising the concerns that were originally brought up in Owens and Wilson. And that's the exact case here. The type of factual analysis that we would be asking this court to perform is no more intrusive than the analysis that was already done and recognized by Hardin. So to us, this case is analogous to what the Supreme Court did in Hardin, and there's an easy path forward by just applying the principles that were used in Hardin. But to the extent that, to the extent that this court has any concerns about the revival provision or the applicability of the revival provision here, there are still two other paths forward, both through statutory equitable tolling and through common law equitable tolling. And under common law equitable tolling, New Jersey has made clear that where a defendant has contributed through their behavior to the expiration of a statute of limitations for a plaintiff, it's inappropriate for that defendant to then use the statute of limitations as a sword against the plaintiff.
What case says that if the defendant has contributed? I don't know. I've seen that language. What case says that?
That comes from Dunn v. Borough of Morningside and Jones v. Jones, which are two New Jersey state law cases. In Dunn, that's it.
And that's what they say, they contributed?
Right. The exact language is, the statute of limitations should not be used as a sword by a defendant whose conduct contributed to the expiration of the statute of limitations. And that's exactly what happened in Ms. Rihanna's case. Here, defendant Fitzgerald made threats against Ms. Rihanna that were designed to follow her both wherever that she went, and also contributed bad behavior to the entirety of the Bureau of Prisons, reasonably making Ms. Rihanna fear that if she spoke out in any way, she would be met with retaliation by the Bureau of Prisons. So
the facts of her cause of action weren't kept from her. The case really talks about when they deny them the facts necessary to know they have a cause of action. She knew she had been raped. There was nothing hidden from her, was there?
She did know that she had been raped, Your Honor, but the key here is that she was induced or tricked by the defendants, which is the standard from New Jersey common law equitable tolling, into missing the filing deadline. So it doesn't really matter that she was aware that she had been raped and perhaps would have had a cause of action. What matters is that defendant Fitzgerald threatened her and said, if you make problems for the Bureau of Prisons, the Bureau of Prisons will make problems for you. And that's at page 77 of the appendix specifically. And because
her reclamation, her determination to then do something about it, didn't come when threats subsided. It came when someone said to her, you know, you have your own rights. You can do this. And she kind of said, well, oh yeah, I guess I do. So it wasn't when a threat abated. It was when the realization came to her, belatedly, obviously, that she had rights to pursue.
So in response to that, Your Honor, the New Jersey equitable common law, equitable tolling standard from common law is specifically whether a defendant has actively misled the plaintiff or shown intentional inducement or trickery. And at the point in time that Ms. Rihanna brought her cause of action initially, she had learned that she had been induced or tricked by Captain Fitzgerald into missing the statute of limitations window. So it was both the fact that she was reasonably afraid by the threats that Captain Fitzgerald had made, but additionally that she was tricked into missing the filing deadline and later came into information that was incorrect and that she had an obligation to file a lawsuit, which again is precisely the type of situation that New Jersey common law provides for when extending equitable tolling principles. Additionally,
can we go back to Hardin for a minute? I'm not sure why that helps you. Tell us again why Hardin helps you.
So the Supreme Court in Hardin was confronted with a case of a prisoner who was trying to use a tolling provision that only applied to prisoners or others with legal disabilities. The Supreme Court there said that that tolling provision, even though it was not generally applicable to every single plaintiff who might have a personal injury claim in the state of Michigan, was still fine to use for that particular situation. So to us, that shows that the Supreme Court has indicated that some level of factual inquiry or some level of difference between plaintiffs, between claims for issues of tolling, revival, and application, other questions of timeliness that accompany the statute of limitations question are fine. That level of variation is not a problem under Owens.
But even if that's true, that statute was not tort specific, was it?
The underlying statute of limitations that was used in Hardin was the state's general personal injury statute of limitations.
Right, and the revival applied to anybody who was injured when they were under 18 years of age, right?
Right, and then the tolling provision on top of that said that any prisoner had the ability to toll their claims until a year after they were released from incarceration. So that provision didn't apply to all.
So that was status specific to the person, but not claim specific. And here we're dealing with a New Jersey law that's claim specific, i.e. sexual abuse, right?
Right, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Before you sit down, can you address the Bivens issue? Let's assume that you prevail on the timeliness. Why, in spite of what we might have said in Bistrian, how can we rule in your favor on Bivens in light of Egbert against Boole, where the Supreme Court, for the first time, specifically identified only three types of acceptable Bivens cases?
So this court, as you said, Judge Hardiman, has indicated that where a prisoner has a cause of action for failure to protect for either sexual assault or physical assault, that's already been recognized as a cause of action through Bistrian and Shorter. This court again recognized that cause of action through She, a case just decided this past
summer. Well, that was a throwaway footnote in She. I think footnote 7, I think.
That is in the footnote, but that's also...
We've got to deal, you know, with what the Supreme Court said in Egbert. So help us with that.
Right. So all Egbert did was reaffirm what was already made plain by Abbasi, which is that extending Bivens to a new context is disfavored judicial activity. Egbert did not give any new information to that fact or to the fact that the three existing contexts for a Bivens remedy are what were listed in through Carlson,
Davis,
thank you, and in anyway, so this, as this court recognized in Bistrian.
Let me just quote what the Supreme Court said there, because I'm not sure you're giving it get full credit. The first step of the Bivens analysis, whether we should recognize a Bivens cause of action according to Egbert, is, quote, whether the case presents a new Bivens context, i.e., is it meaningfully different from the three cases in which the court has implied a damages action?
Sure. So we don't believe that there's any meaningful difference between the case that Ms. Brianna is presenting and the cases that this court has already recognized through Bistrian Shorter and again through She. I know you said that was just a throwaway footnote, but in the above-the-line text of She, this court said, and we too have refused to extend Bivens except in one of these three established contexts, specifically pointing to Bistrian as one of those three established contexts.
All right, so your argument is that our precedents remain intact after Egbert.
That's right, Your Honor.
All right.
But I see my time, so unless the court has further questions,
we'll hear you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Judo?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Angela Juno, Assistant U.S. Attorney, on behalf of the appellees. We ask this court to affirm the district court order dismissing the appellant's complaint in its entirety. If I may, Your Honors, I'd like to begin with a couple of points that the that the appellant's attorney, my friend, made about NJSA, excuse me, 2814-2B. First of all, she said that the Supreme Court in Wilson v. Garcia and Owens v. Acure only addressed the statute of limitations issue and did not address revival or tolling provisions, right? And she is correct. The Supreme Court said we no longer want courts to engage in a tort-specific analysis of statute of limitations and didn't extend that to tolling and revival provisions. But I would note that those cases were back in the 80s. And since then, as we know here in New Jersey, only very recently did the New Jersey legislature create a set of tolling provisions that were specific to sexual assault provisions. And in the second, ninth, and the 10th circuits, which have also addressed tort-specific revival and statute revival provisions, they tend to come up in the sexual assault arena, which are fairly new and didn't exist back then. But I think, Your Honors, if you look at the way that the doctrine evolved, in 85, the court decides Wilson v. Garcia and says, listen, we're done with lower courts doing this tort-specific analysis to determine which statute of limitations applies in a 1983 claim. And it thought it had put the matter to bed, but it had to come back 4 years later in Owens v. Acure to clarify that it wasn't just any statute of limitations, excuse me, any personal injury statute of limitations. It also wanted courts to stop this specific analysis of which personal injury statute of limitations applied. So I think that
But wasn't Owens in the context of, okay, was this an intentional tort? Was this a negligent homicide? Was this, they have to actually decide the case before deciding what statute of limitations was. Here, sexual assault, pretty clear, pretty easy, not a lot of factual analysis necessary in order to say, I'm suing because I was assaulted sexually. So is this the kind of situation where the Supreme Court would say, well, here you don't have to try the case in order to decide what you have to determine what the statute of limitations is? It's pretty clear. So why doesn't Owens' concern for factual analysis really, it was misplaced in this context?
Well, Your Honor, because it still requires the court to look to the cause of action. 2A14-2B only applies to sexual assault claims. That's clear. And it requires the court, require the district court to look at the case and say, is this a sexual assault claim? And that is precisely what the Supreme Court said it did not want lower courts to do. It wanted it to stop this factual analysis. And this is very different. I know my friend relies heavily on Hardin. Hardin was a very different case. As Judge Hardiman, as you acknowledged, that was a case in which the tolling provision applied to prisoners generally. And so there, the court was tasked with looking at who's the plaintiff. That is very different than looking at what is the cause of action. And importantly, as my friend also noted, it's clear, the Supreme Court's clear, the parties are in agreement that closely related tolling provisions apply to 1983 actions. But the issue is that, as Your Honor noted, in Owens, it explicitly prohibited district courts from engaging in this tort-specific analysis. And that is not the kind of analysis that the Supreme Court needed to do in Hardin. It was only looking at the personal injury statute of limitations. And I would just add, Your Honors, and Your Honor, Judge Rendell, you said this, but I think that the Second Circuit got this exactly right in Kane when it said it would strain credulity to think that the Supreme Court would prohibit district courts from engaging in a fact-specific analysis for purposes of statute of limitations, but then turn around and allow them to do that exact analysis in regard to tolling and revival provisions. And
Owens didn't say anything about tolling and revival, correct?
It did not, Your Honor.
Do you have any precedent to help us as to what we can or can't borrow in those areas, recognizing that when it comes to the SOL, we're dealing strictly with the general?
Right. So closely related tolling provisions, right? That's what Wilson said. Closely related tolling provisions apply to 1983 actions. Now, the Supreme Court did not define exactly what closely related meant, but the Supreme Court in Cain said, we'll tell you what closely related means. It means if it applies to all of the claims within the general residual personal injury statute of limitations, which was the case in Hardin. Again, that was about who the plaintiff was. So if you took that tolling provision, it fits in squarely with what we're arguing. The New Jersey legislature passed a statute that tolled claims for prisoners, that would apply here because that does not require the court to engage in a tort-specific factual analysis that's prohibited by Wilson.
But there's no precedent directly preventing us from applying a different rule to revival statutes than we would apply to statute limitations. Is it your argument that it would just be counterintuitive to do it, even though there's nothing that says we can't do it?
Correct, Your Honor. It would be counterintuitive. And counterintuitive, I believe, is the exact language that the Ninth Circuit used in addressing this issue. What would be
so bad as a policy matter? What would be the adverse downstream consequences if we were to do the counterintuitive thing?
The problem, Your Honor, is that it explicitly violates the directive from Owens v. Acure, which is that 1983 actions, courts should no longer do this tort-specific analysis. And what the court was getting at in, in Wilson was up until that point, in order to get a more favorable statute of limitations, the plaintiffs were arguing, well, look, my case is really more like a property claim, or it's more like a contract claim.
I'm going to go into the gist of the action doctrine here in these cases, I guess. That's the risk?
That's the risk. And the court specifically said, both in Wilson and then again in Owens, it wanted to create uniformity. It wanted to create uniformity among all 50 states. And so that is what, that's the issue here. For the court to go against that and state that 2A14-2B would apply, it would require this court to do that kind of analysis that is prohibited. And admittedly,
from a predictive standpoint, I could see the Supreme Court looking at this and saying, 27 states have enacted these provisions. This is different from Owens. There's no factual analysis here required. These are recognized specific sexual assault. Pretty clear. There's no analysis necessary here. We're going to carve this out and say you can have a 1983 action to deprive citizens of states that have said you can bring these actions, from having a remedy against a federal official, is just wrong. Could you see that from a predictive standpoint?
I can, Your Honor, but here's the problem. What will wind up happening, so I will say this. I think at the moment, I'll say this. The appellant is only arguing that this specific tolling provision applies, right? But were the New Jersey legislature tomorrow to turn around and pass a tolling provision stating that any prisoner who's bringing a failure to protect claim is entitled to an additional period of tolling, the court would be faced with two, just like it was in Wilson and just like it was in Owens, two potentially applicable tolling provisions that the court would then have to sit down and determine which of these tolling provisions should apply. And that is where we get right back to the court's analysis in Owens and in Wilson, that because there are all these conflicting and potentially applicable statutes of limitation, they wanted to create uniformity. So that would be the issue, Your Honor.
Do we get to the question of whether there is a Bivens claim? There was nothing decided in the district court at all. In the case law that where there's qualified immunity, they say, well, the district court obviously had to decide whether there was a claim. But here we have nothing decided by the district court. Do we even go there?
No, Your Honors, do not need to address the Bivens issue. Your Honors can simply affirm the district court holding, finding that NJSA 2A14-2B does not apply to the plaintiff's claims, just like the 2nd, 9th, and 10th circuits have held, and further that the appellant is not entitled to equitable tolling for the reasons that the court held below. So the court need not reach the Bivens issue.
All right, but assume for a minute that they're timely. if they're timely, or if we don't want to run the risk of saying that they're untimely and we're wrong, that might be another reason to address Bivens. What's your best argument there?
So my best argument there, Your Honor, is that in Egbert, well, let me take a step back. In Bistrian, where this court recognized that Farmer continued to be an active cause of action, this court gave two lines of reasoning for why Farmer remained viable. Number one was that this court said, look, Farmer's never been overruled, but Egbert directly undermines that. In Egbert, the Supreme Court considered the Hartman case, which was a case in which it had assumed a First Amendment cause of action under Bivens, but never did a Bivens analysis, which is exactly what happened in Farmer. In Farmer, the court assumed a cause of action. And in Egbert, the Supreme Court said, we assumed a cause of action, but we never held that there was a cause of action. And that analysis applies directly to Farmer and to this court's holding in Bistrian. The second line of reasoning in Bistrian was this court said, the Supreme Court may not be listing Farmer in its three Bivens causes of actions because it sees Farmer as being indistinct from Carlson. That was what the court said. But as my friend pointed to in Gee, this court said, we have failed to extend Bivens in a number of circumstances, but we did extend Bivens in Bistrian. And so this court acknowledged that Bistrian was an extension of the Bivens doctrine.
He was decided after Egbert, wasn't it?
It was, Your Honor. That's exactly right. But by acknowledging that it had extended Bivens, that means that the court would have to do an analysis and determine whether that cause of action continues to exist. And as this court noted in Gee, Egbert tells us that almost parallel circumstances are not enough. The court needs only one reason not to extend Bivens any further. And I think that as we've stated extensively in our brief, given the court's extremely strong language in Egbert that has dramatically reduced the Bivens field, I don't see how the court can continue to acknowledge Farmer as a cause of action. If the court has no further questions, I'm happy to cede my last minute or two.
Do we have to ignore or distinguish some of our later cases then, if we're to find out that you're...
If the court were to find that Farmer were no longer a viable cause of action? I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that, well, this court has said in Mack v. Yost, and again in Bistrian, that whenever there is, that Abbasi had made clear, that whenever lower courts were relying on their own Bivens precedent, that they can no longer do so to recognize a Bivens remedy. And so that would apply here. I think that the court can state that Egbert has abrogated its holding in Bistrian and in Shorter, and the court need not go any further than that.
Judge Rendell, anything further for Ms. Juneau?
Maybe just a comment on where the conduct contributed. She was actively misled, intentional, yes, inducement, or trickery. Why don't these threats, seek and find you, we're going to make trouble for you if you do something. Why isn't that enough?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. First of all, the appellant has not alleged that any of the four named defendants engaged in trickery or induced her not to file suit. That's number one. It was an unnamed party who's never been a named defendant. Number two, though, and this is most important, the allegations simply do not support a finding of equitable tolling under any of the case law that the appellant has cited. Appellant has looked to, for example, Dunn, which was a state of New Jersey case in which the court found that equitable tolling was warranted as a result of trickery. But in that instance, the defendant, a police officer, actually withheld his identity from the plaintiff, so she couldn't bring suit. Very different from here. The plaintiff knew who the defendant was, knew she had been raped, and was able to bring suit. And then similarly, this court in Frazier v. Cain rejected an equitable tolling analysis or an equitable tolling argument. I see I'm out of time. May I? Thank you very much, Your Honor.
That was a non-precedential opinion, was it not?
It was. That's correct, Your Honor. But I think it's helpful because in that instance...
That was Judge Sirica's opinion. It's still...
So we'll say it's precedential today. But yes, in that instance, the defendant, again, a police officer, had threatened the plaintiff. And this court said that that was simply not enough to rise to the extraordinary circumstances that warrant equitable tolling. And again, equitable tolling is an extraordinary remedy that is only found in extremely rare circumstances. And the district court was correct in finding that these are not those circumstances. I thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Juneau. Let's hear the rebuttal from Attorney Meth.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have three quick points and one clarification. First, there are three independent reasons that make Ms. Rihanna's claims timely today, and the court need only reach one of those to be able to reverse and remand down to the lower court. The quick factual clarification is that many of the threats that were alleged in the record by Ms. Rihanna were by Captain Fitzgerald, who is a defendant in this case. And I believe just now my friend said that none of the named defendants made any threats against her. Just wanted to clarify that. Second, the point that Judge Rendell was speaking about with my friend on the other side, that it is not any harder to address who the plaintiff might be in a particular case than the type of claim that is being offered in a particular case is one that we believe is important and holds true here. And that's evidenced by the fact that the Supreme Court, in deciding the scheme of statute of limitations that was appropriate, did not require that all states have the same limitations periods or the same rules around tolling and revival and application. There's already variation built into the scheme, and the variation that would be created by this court holding that the New Jersey revival provision applies is just that same type of variation that's already been recognized. And third and finally, the list of three cases that you referenced, Judge Hardiman, in Abbasi that set the Supreme Court's parameters for what constitutes a Bivens claim, those do come from Abbasi, not necessarily just Egbert. And this court decided Bistrian and Shorter after Abbasi when it already knew that the Supreme Court had limited the scope of when Bivens remedies apply. So again, Egbert does not change that world and is only...
And none of the three cases involve prisoner-on-prisoner violence, right? We'd have to reason by analogy if we were going to fit this case into one of those three.
That would be true, but this court has already done so through Bistrian and Shorter, so it would just be recognizing precedent that's already true in this court. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Meth. Thank you, Ms. Juneau. The court will take the matter under advisement.
Recording stopped.